If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
When I arrived in Paris for the first time, came out of the Gare du Nord and saw these policemen, you know, in their little white caps, and they all carried little white batons in those days, directing the traffic. And then there was the Eiffel Tower, you know. And I said to myself, I'm abroad. This is Paris. So I remember it as if it was yesterday now, and the excitement of it.
That was John Julius Norwich talking about his personal connections to the history of France.
Listening to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine. We're the UK's best-selling history magazine, available in print and several digital formats all over the world. Find out more at historyextra.com/subscribe or look out for us in your digital newsstand or app store.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast. I'm Rob Attar, the editor of BBC History Magazine. For today's interview, we're going to be talking to John Julius Norwich, a historian and author whose literary career stretches back more than 50 years. His latest book, France, A History from Gaul to De Gaulle, is published this week, and as the title suggests, covers more than 2,000 years of France's story. Our staff writer Ellie Cawthorne met up with John Julius in his London home to find out more about his take on French history and his own part in some of these events.
So I'm joined by John Julius Norwich. And so your latest book is France, A History from Gaul to De Gaulle. It's quite a lot to cover there, isn't there?
There's a good deal to cover, but I rather like covering long areas. It means you don't have to bury so deep and you can keep the thing going, you can keep the story going. That's a great thing.
In the introduction to the book, you start by sharing some personal memories about France, including your first trip in 1936.
Yes.
Perhaps you could just tell us, to begin with, a little bit about your own connection to the country and why you wanted to write a history of it.
Well, my own connections go back, as you say, to 1936. I spent my seventh birthday in France, September 36, and my mother took me to France the first time, just she and me. And I always remember, of course, in those days, you naturally, I mean, you went by boat. There was no other way to go. And we went, and I was incredibly excited. The first time I'd ever been on a big ship, you know, I mean, anything bigger than a rowing boat. And so that was in itself terribly exciting. It was fairly rough, I remember, but I was too excited to be seasick, I think. And then I remember the wonderfully exciting moment when I arrived in Paris for the first time, came out of the Gare du Nord and saw these policemen, you know, in their little white caps, and they all carried little white batons in those days, directing the traffic. And then there was the Eiffel Tower, you know, and I said to myself, I'm abroad. This is Paris, you know. And I was so excited. I remember it as if it was yesterday now, you know, and the excitement of it. And then we went to France three or four times before the war. And then, of course, the war came and that put an end to all that. But then I was one of the first of my friends, I think probably one of the first of my generation, to go back there at the end of the war, because Paris was liberated at the end of August 1944. And my father was made ambassador. He was the first post-war ambassador. And, well, it wasn't even post-war. The war was still going on. And I went out to Paris to, on my Christmas holidays that year. So I was there while the war was still going on, 3 months after the liberation. And very few other people, except people in the armed forces, were going there by that time. And it was pretty uncomfortable, I remember. I mean, it was the coldest winter they'd had for 50 years. And there was nobody had any fuel or heating, except, thank God, the British Embassy, which was the warmest toast. So, you know, I mean, nobody ever refused an invitation to the British Embassy. It was the only place that was warm. It was also the only place that had unlimited gin and whiskey, which the French had not seen for 5 years. So that made us even more popular. And we were there for 3 years, and I would go in my holidays. And, you know, I got to know it and spoke the language very fluently and just loved it from the start and always have.
You have a remarkable anecdote in the opener about meeting de Gaulle. Perhaps you could share that with us.
You know, de Gaulle was the most difficult man in the world. He was insufferable. Nobody could get on with him. He was perhaps a great man in many ways. Well, he was. We all know that. But, I mean, Winston Churchill couldn't bear him. Nobody could bear him. And my father had the most awful time with him again and again and again. And I think I'm the only person who had a conversation that ended up friendly. It was a very short conversation, admittedly. But what happened, it was the second anniversary of the D-Day landings on the Normandy beaches. And there was a big ceremony on the beaches and a sort of memorial service and all that sort of thing in the morning. And then everybody went off to an old sort of beach hotel for a big, big lunch. And there was all the top brass there, from General de Gaulle down, you know, all the generals and the admirals and God knows who. And I was 17. But anyway, I had to drive out that morning. I remember it very well because it was the first long drive I'd ever done solo. I'd only just got my license. And I got hopelessly lost and eventually arrived at this great party just as lunch was finishing. And I was ravenously hungry. And there was not a chance of anything. Everything was gone, you know, all over. Everybody was packing up and going home. And I went into the kitchen to see if I could find anything. No good, nothing at all. And then I'd been introduced to de Gaulle on my arrival. And I'd been very gratified by the fact that for this snotty-nosed 17-year-old, he had actually stood up. He'd unwound all 6'5", you know, to shake my hand. I thought, well, that's pretty good, you know, General Gaulle gets up for me, you know, and all that was rather marvellous. But I was really only thinking of my stomach at that point. And then eventually I suddenly saw that in front of de Gaulle there was this, as far as I could see, untouched plate of apple pie. And I said to my mother, I said, do you think the General's going to eat his apple pie? Because if he isn't, I know who is. And my mother said, well, you better ask him, haven't you? And I said, go on, ask him, you know. And so it was a tussle between fear and greed. But greed won. And I went and said, excusez-moi, mon général, mais est-ce que vous allez manger votre tarte aux pommes? And he said, no, that's fine, you take it. Then it was a smile. I mean, nobody ever saw General Gaulle smile. And then he said, I'm sorry, I've spilt rather a lot of cigarette ash on it. And I said, I think I realised even when I said it, it would be an honour to eat the General's cigarette ash. Anyway, that's what I did say. And it went down terribly well. It was a big success, I was. And that was the end of the conversation, and the only conversation I ever had with him. But at least it ended on a happy note, which most of them haven't.
You suggest in the book that the average English person has a pretty woeful knowledge of French history. What do you think are some of the biggest or most exciting stories from French history that we really just don't know that much about in England?
I got the feeling that most English people knew practically nothing about it. I mean, I didn't, or even living in France, I knew very, very little about it. And, I mean, what do they teach us at school? They teach us the battles we won, of which there were four: Crécy, Poitiers, Agincourt and Waterloo. We get those more or less straight. And then we hear a little bit more about Napoleon, perhaps. Maybe a little bit more about Louis XIV. And that's it, you know. So there's quite a lot to do. And a lot of it was brand new to me, I have to tell you, you know. There was a marvellous scandal in about 1320, where the king, Philip IV, had three sons. And the three sons were married to three ladies. And the three ladies were having a tremendous time with three chaps in a very old medieval tower called the La Tour de Nesle, which is on in Paris. It stood until the revolution when it was destroyed. And it was discovered, actually, by the Queen of England, who happened to be these girls' sister-in-law, the wife of Edward II. She was there, and she discovered what these girls were up to. And she told the king. And there was this terrific scandal, and the three girls, all of whom the three husbands were all kings, one after the other. And they would have all been queens if this hadn't happened, you know. And there were all these sort of great sort of knightly trysts in the Tour de Nesle, this sort of very spooky old medieval tower, you know. Alexandre Dumas wrote an often enjoyable novel about it. Anyway, then there was this big inquiry, and they were all put in prison. One of them actually got off a bit later on because it was agreed that she'd only watched. She hadn't really been involved. But the other two had been involved, all right. And one of them, both of them were put in prison. One of them came out and was murdered by her husband about two or three days later, smothered. So that he could marry someone else. And her reputation was in tatters. She wasn't going to be able to be queen anyway, you know, but he got rid of her quickly that way. Another one remained for the rest of her life in a cell. Eventually, I think she joined a nunnery, but it was still a cell. And the last one was forgiven and came back and indeed became queen. So that was rather a sort of a nice, amusing story. But Alexandre Dumas thought it was anyway, so what was good enough with him is good enough for me. They're all rather scandalous, these stories that come to mind. There was the very unfortunate story of President Félix Faure, who was president of France during the Dreyfus case, about sort of 1895, you know, that sort of time. And President Félix Faure died of an apoplectic stroke when, in full flagrante, on the presidential desk, I may say, with a lady called Madame Marguerite Steinheil, who was extremely beautiful, married to a rather unsuccessful portrait painter. And they had a terrible time because she started screaming. He just had a sudden apoplectic stroke. And some of her hair was tied up, and he got his hand caught in some of her hair. So the secretaries came, who knew perfectly well what was going on. They came in and sort of snipped the hair off so that she could, freeing her from the president, and got her out the back way. And it was all beautifully hushed up. The Weekly Digest, like the Illustrated London News, it used to be in this country, it was called L'Illustration. And they had these lovely woodcuts. It was just before photography. And they did these beautiful, beautiful woodcuts. And there was this lovely woodcut of President Félix Faure on his deathbed, like that, in full evening dress, and Madame Faure and all the little Faures all round the bed, you know, doing things like this. And we all know it wasn't like that at all. So that was fun.
You've definitely got an eye for a colourful character, haven't you?
Well, there was one other character, President Deschanel, in 1920, and I didn't know this until I started writing the book. He'd been a very, very distinguished man, member of the Académie Française, written hundreds of books. I mean, very, very grand. And he was made president of France, and that was all wonderful. And it was fine for 6 months. And then 6 months later, a delegation from some girls' school arrived with a big bouquet of flowers for him. And they handed it over, and he said, thanks very much. And then in the ensuing conversation, he started pelting these girls with the flowers. Everybody thought that was a bit odd. And eventually, anyway, they realised that he had to go. They walked into a lake with nothing on, that's right, I remember. And anyway, they realised he had to go. And then the last thing that happened was that nobody quite knew how, but he was travelling somewhere on the presidential train through France. And somehow he fell out of the window, or maybe he opened the door. Anyway, they found him in his pajamas. Suddenly, I think the train wasn't moving fast. May have been stationary, I don't know. And they found him sort of in his pyjamas, wandering around completely hopelessly, not knowing, having any idea where he was at all, you know. That was the last thing that happened.
We don't always realise just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger. Talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
One of the figures that obviously always looms large in French history is Napoleon. Historians have waxed lyrical about, was he a dictator? Was he a military magic worker? What is your take on Napoleon?
Well, it's the hardest question in the world. And sometimes I think one thing, sometimes, was he a blessing or a curse? It's basically, put it in one sentence, you know. I mean, he was unquestionably, I think, he's one of the greatest men who ever lived. People who had never put pen to paper, the moment they met Napoleon, they went back and wrote all about it, because he had such an extraordinary personality, such incredible magnetism. This tiny little man, he was only 5'4", you know, and he just radiated, clearly. One would love to have known him. He radiated this sort of charisma. And he was in, not only that, but of course he had boundless energy and immense self-confidence. I mean, he knew that whatever he did, it was going to work, was right, you know. And this huge courage. I mean, when he first distinguished himself, the siege of Toulon, when he was about 24 years old, his commanding officer said, let this man do anything he wants, A, because he's going to get it right, and B, because if you don't, there'll be trouble. You know, he was sort of dominating everybody around him. And then by the time he was 30, he'd conquered most of Italy and a good deal of Europe. He crowned himself emperor. Kings, of course, he had a bad name by then. I mean, the last king had been guillotined only 10 years before. And so kings were unpopular. But emperors were like Roman emperors. I mean, they were different. They were good things. Kings were bad things, but emperors were good things. And so Napoleon decided to be a good thing and crowned himself and Josephine emperor. He insisted on the Pope coming. The Pope didn't want to come at all. I mean, because all the other crowned heads of Europe, you know, were horrified, this Corsican adventurer coming in, calling himself an emperor, you know, and all that. The idea that the Pope should be present and give it his blessings. On the other hand, the Pope was far too frightened not to, so did. And then was humiliated by not being allowed to do any crowning himself. I mean, he was allowed to bless the couple afterwards, but Napoleon consecrated himself and then crowned Josephine. And the Pope wasn't allowed to touch the crowns at all, you know. Napoleon always made it absolutely clear who was boss. And then, I mean, all right, then his career was relatively short. I mean, it starts in about 1796, or let's say, you know, Waterloo, 1815, 20 years. at the most, you know. And yet in that 20 years, he changed the world more than any other single man has ever done. I mean, two dozen countries are still using the Code Napoleon, the legal code, which he more or less invented, named after him. Today, he completely changed the entire map of Europe. He radiated the principles of the French Revolution, I mean, liberty, equality, fraternity, and all that, you know. In some way, he woke up the whole of Europe to these new and exciting ideas, which have also, of course, stuck until the present day. But on the other side of the medal, he was certainly responsible, I think, for the death of a couple of million soldiers who would otherwise have remained alive. He twice deserted his army in the hour of need, the first time on the Egyptian expedition, 1798, when he was very, very young, you know. And he had this tremendous the Battle of the Nile, and Nelson destroyed the French fleet. And then Napoleon was there. He tried to turn the whole thing into a victory, but it wasn't. It was really a nasty humiliation. But meanwhile, very exciting things. In 1798, very exciting things were happening in Paris. People were changing over, and he had to be there. So one night he just left the entire army in midsummer in Egypt to get back as best it could. He didn't even tell the second-in-command that he was going. He just wasn't there the next morning, you know, and just abandoned it. And he did the same thing in 1812 in Russia. Left his entire army in that freezing cold. First time he left in boiling, sweltering Egyptian heat. Second time in this bitter Russian cold, in order to come back and further his own career. So, I mean, that wasn't very nice. What is very curious, and still I think very mysterious, is his sudden collapse. And in Waterloo, of course, he was a shadow of his former self. He really played very, very little part in the battle. A lot of the time, I think he spent just burying his head in his hands in terrible pain. He had terrible piles. That was one of his troubles. He couldn't sit on a horse very well by then. And, I mean, if he'd been in good nick, I think he would probably have won Waterloo. I mean, Duke of Wellington said it was a damn close-run thing, you know. And it was. And I think if Napoleon had been like he had been 10 years before, at Austerlitz or somewhere like that, he'd have made mincemeat out of us. And then England would have probably been part of his empire as well. You know, I mean, where would he have ended? It was a damn close run thing. It was a narrow escape. This country would be very, very different today if Waterloo had gone the other way.
Of course, no history of France can be complete without the Revolution, which you do obviously cover. What's your take on it? How events unfolded, but also how we should look back on it?
I think, there's no question whether the Revolution was a disaster. I'm not saying that all the old values should have been maintained. But things had to change. But they didn't have to change quite the way they did change, with this immense amount of bloodshed. I mean, the trouble was that old Louis XVI was a very, very stupid man. And he just didn't see the point at all. He couldn't understand. He was unbelievably indecisive. He sort of swayed this way and that and couldn't make up his mind, you know. And he was a pretty good disaster, and Marie Antoinette didn't help either. And she was hated from the beginning, merely because she was Austrian. And then, of course, I mean, what nobody could have foreseen was the immediate consequences of the execution of the king, which was the terror, when they were guillotining 200-300 people a day for 6 months. You know, it's absolutely unbelievable. And they were guillotining people on charges for having said that they thought the monarchy wasn't a bad idea after all, or something like that. That was enough to get your head chopped off. And it was absolutely unbelievable. It went on and on and on. And eventually, of course, it devoured its own children, because all the leaders of the revolution all ended on the guillotine, including Robespierre, who was the most sinister and horrible of all of them. And he ended up on the guillotine himself. He just had half his face shot off a few hours before. And it was the most awful story. I mean, his death is really the most horrible of all, as he was the most horrible of all the revolutionaries. But, I mean, it ended up in such unbelievable bloodshed, which was quite unnecessary. And it spoilt the effects of the revolution, which might otherwise have been a good revolution. I mean, it might have landed France much a happier country than it had ever been. But in fact, it had the opposite effect. It made France absolutely miserable, to the point where the revolutions continued, small revolutions, went on virtually all through the 19th century. You know, it's in the reign of Louis Philippe, in the reign of Napoleon III, revolution, up to people putting up the barricades in the streets and people getting murdered or shot in cold blood or something, sometimes in hot blood. It's the whole story of 19th century France is much, much bloodier than I thought it was. I was very surprised just how much blood was shed in the subsequent post-revolutionary years between, let's say, the coming of Napoleon in 1797. And then it was fine. I mean, that was the end of the terror and all that. I mean, then France at least was on a good, even, disciplined keel. But after Napoleon had gone, again, nobody could quite keep order. You see, they had revolutions in 1830, had another one in 1848. The National Guard took over. You had the Commune, which was exactly like the revolution all over again. And that's in 1871. I mean, that was very nearly a century after the revolution. And France was still in a mess because of this.
Some people would have written, thousand-word volumes on 1 year of the French Revolution, whereas you've got 2,000 years to cover in 360 pages.
Yes.
Why do you like writing in a kind of big picture, broad strokes, fast-paced style? Why does that style appeal to you?
Well, the first thing to say about that is that deep down, I'm shallow. I'm not an academic. I'm not a professor. I would never call myself a historian. I write history, but I think that's, in my view, not quite the same. I mean, in 30 years, 40 years, 50 years now, it is actually, I think, almost, that I've been writing, except in one case, which is the Normans and Sicily, the first book I ever wrote. Then I was forging rather new ground. But since then, I don't think I've discovered, I haven't pushed the boundaries of knowledge any further back. I haven't discovered any new historical facts. I mean, because I don't go plunging into monastic libraries, which I couldn't read even if I did. What I'm interested in doing is telling a really good story as amusingly and as accurately as I can. And I want my ideal reward is that my readers should say, gee whiz, how fascinating, I never knew that before. I want to be amusing and I want to be readable.
Looking at France today, how do you see all these thousands of years history shaping the way that the country is today?
Well, I'm not sure that modern France has been shaped by anything much further back, really, than the revolution. I think it's still feeling the after effects of that and will continue to do so for a long time to come. But it has had, in the last 70 or 80 years, since the, let's say in my lifetime, I was born in 1929, it has had the most extraordinary up and down history. I mean, there was the disaster of 1940 and the great humiliation felt by a great many French people at the time of the complete collapse of the country and their capitulation and the occupied France and Pétain and all that. And then the splendour, which for all his faults, I think you could say the splendour of De Gaulle, because he did come from absolutely nothing and, founded the Free French and got the whole thing going. He did it by being absolutely bloody to people, but he did it, and you can't take that away from him. And then when he left the picture, it all went very much downhill again. Now we've got this sort of new phenomenon, Monsieur Macron, who seems to me to be a very exciting new thing. I mean, I think he's doing extremely well. And I think he's only been in power for whatever it is, less than a year. But it seems to me that he's already given a lot of French people a sort of new excitement and pride and, you know, a thrill about the future. And now suddenly they've got this young live wire who promises much and may deliver.
Of course, one of the things that Macron has promised is that the Bayeux Tapestry is going to come on loan to England for the first time ever. I was just wondering, what your thoughts on that were.
Well, I'm absolutely thrilled. I'm delighted. It's a marvellous thing, the Bayeux Tapestry. It's so funny. It's hilariously funny. It's like a very, very good comic strip, you know. It's full of marvellous jokes, and the pictures are extraordinary. And if we can show it half as well as it's shown there in Bayeux now, it'll be a huge success.
In your introduction to the book, you say that this might be the last book that you write. If that were to be the case, what do you want people to take away from it?
Well, I don't think what I want them to take away from it is nothing to do with it being the last book. I think it's the last book I'm going to write simply because I'm 88 years old and I haven't got much time left. Nor, I think, do I have, frankly, the energy to do another one. But I might start just to keep myself occupied, I don't know. But what I want people to carry away from it is what I want people to carry away from every other book I've ever written, I say. That of a thundering good story told as well as I can do it, which they've enjoyed reading and are surprised at how wonderful the story was, you know. That's what I've tried to do all my life, seek out good stories and tell them as well as I can. It's been as simple as that, really.
That was John Julius Norwich. France, A History from Gaul to De Gaulle is published on Thursday, the 5th of April, by John Murray. And you can read a version of this interview in the April issue of BBC History magazine, which is on sale now, and also includes articles on the RAF in World War II, Alexander Hamilton, medieval mystics, and Martin Luther King. Look out for it in all good retailers and our many digital formats now. And meanwhile, if you'd like to find out more about the story of the Norman Conquest, a key incident in the history of both France and England, then you may well be interested in our Bayeux Tapestry event, taking place in Oxford on the 17th of June. Head to historyextra.com/events for more details of that. OK, well, that's about all for today, but please do rejoin us on Thursday when we'll be talking about medieval mysticism with Hetta Howes.
Thanks for listening to this History Extra podcast, which was produced by Jack Fletcher. Do let us know what you think about this episode by emailing podcast@historyextra.com, and we might read out your messages in future editions. Alternatively, why not keep in touch via Twitter or Facebook, where you'll find us at History Extra. For more great history content, don't forget to visit our website, historyextra.com, which is full of history articles, quizzes, image galleries, and more. Plus, it's where you can download hundreds of previous episodes of this podcast.